Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you're into the movies, this is the best time of the year. But if you're determined to see all the good ones, you better come up with a battle plan. There's just too many. Why do the studios always pack in the movies for grown-ups into the last few weeks of the year anyway? And do you really want to see a deep, dark film on Christmas week? Joining me now to talk about the season for smart movies and to tip you off to some of the notable ones this year are Slate's film critic Dana Stevens and David Carr, the New York Times business columnist and media reporter. Welcome back, both of you. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
Happy holidays.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Dana.
Hey,
hi.
David, why do the studios pack in the serious movies into the last few weeks of the year?
I'm sure it'll stun you to hear that I think it's probably money that makes them do it. There's long been a theory that if you put movies at the end of the year, it'll receive more attention from the Academy, pick up some nominations, and then there'll be time to use those nominations to sell the film to audiences. Funny thing about that, in the last few years, there hasn't been much of a bounce at the box office from Oscar nominations, so it's a theory that has no proof.
Right. Last year's big winner, Slumdog Millionaire, came out earlier in the year, didn't it?
And Departed the year before that. I think it's a superstition on the part of the industry that really hasn't held much water in the last couple of years.
And this year people are similarly talking about films that came out earlier in the year, I think, like The Hurt Locker and The Messenger. So, Dana, do you agree briefly that the Oscar bump theory of December releases is falling away?
It seems like it has been happening these last few years because, well, it goes hand-in-hand with the phenomenon of the movies that sweep the Oscars not necessarily being the big studio blockbusters. They've been these little come-from-behind movies, and I have a feeling Hurt Locker may be in that position this year.
Nevertheless, we see some of the good ones, the good serious ones, popping up in the theaters this month that are clear contenders for Oscars. We keep hearing about Up in the Air with George Clooney, which I haven't seen yet, nor have I seen Invictus with Morgan Freeman and Matt Damon. Here's a clip from Up in the Air. George Clooney plays a guy whose job it is to fly around the country firing people.
I don't spend a nickel if I can help it unless it somehow profits my mileage account.
So what are you saving up for, Hawaii? South of France?
It's not like that. The miles are the goal.
That's it? You're saving just to save?
Let's just say that I have a number in mind and I haven't hit it yet.
It's a little abstract. What's the target?
I'd rather not.
Is it a secret target?
It's 10 million miles.
Okay. Isn't 10 million just a number?
Pi's just a number.
Well, we all need a hobby. No, I don't mean to belittle your collection. I get it. It sounds cool.
I'd be the seventh person to do it. More people have walked on the moon.
Did they throw you a parade?
You get lifetime executive status. You get to meet the chief pilot, Maynard Finch.
Wow.
And they put your name on the side of a plane.
If you guys don't grow up, it's like you need to pee on everything.
That clip from Up in the Air. And Dana, I guess George Clooney isn't playing the pure crusader there. I guess he's the soulless corporate operator in this case, huh?
But he can't escape being George Clooney no matter what he does. I mean, the character that he's playing, at least in the book Up in the Air, is quite an unsympathetic guy. But with George Clooney on the screen, it's fantastic Mr. Fox in the sky. You can't not love him. That clip, though, does also showcase a really great performance that nearly steals that scene from George Clooney, which is Anna Kendrick's in the supporting role of a young girl that he's mentoring, who I think is going to get lots of attention to and probably some good roles from this movie.
And she's in Twilight. How's that for a combination? I assume you're not going to endorse the Twilight series.
Well, that's a funny 1-2 punch to see Anna Kendrick in her little part as the Valley Girl in Twilight and then see her in a bigger role in Up in the Air. But I do confess a sneaking affection for Twilight. I'm not going to say it's one of the smart movies of the year, but it's one of the pleasures.
And in your review of Up in the Air, you wrote that you almost immediately downgraded it from sparkling to smug.
Yeah, Up in the Air, I don't know about you, David, but I feel like the more distance I get from that movie, the less I like it, although I had a lot of fun while in the theater. I have a feeling that it's going to get so much recognition because it's so likable, but I just feel like there's not quite enough there.
I can't really agree with you. I mean, listen to that clip, and it's hard not to say I should see that movie. I I'm a little in the tank because I did a story about Jason Reitman, who directed it, and I like Juno, the other movie he made, or Thank You for Smoking. But I do think it hits that sweet spot during award season of crowd-pleasing box office churning and then perhaps award-getting. There's a little Venn diagram between those two things, and maybe Avatar will sneak in there as well, where something not only pleases audiences, pleases critics, and may in fact please the Academy.
But David, for you as a media business reporter, what about this as crowd-pleasing in box office? I mean, if you've recently been laid off, do you really want to see a movie about people getting laid off, and do you want to see that movie around the holidays? What's the business calculation there?
You most certainly do, in part because the people who've been laid off in the film are people just like you. They are real people that responded to an open call, and they're given a chance to work through that part of their lives in front of the camera, and I think it's very riveting movie making. Now, I haven't lost my job yet, knock on wood, but I think there's something somewhat cathartic in having people be able to discuss what's on the other end of this transaction when someone says, well, 800 people were laid off yesterday. Each of them has families, each of them has lives, and each of those decisions has consequences. And I think Up in the Air gets at it. I don't find it to be a smug film.
So, Dana, how do you compare The Road, the adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's apocalyptic novel released last month? This one's a real downer, very dark, and it did not do well at the box office. Do you think that kind of movie can ever do well, or does it pass some kind of darkness threshold where it'll just never draw audiences?
Right. Well, The Road is a really excellent example for that question because it is so dark. I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but anyone who's read the book knows what I'm talking about. I mean, it is so dark and so heavy, and it's about the end of the world, and there's just only the tiniest shred of hope to cling to. So, no, it is really, really hard to see that being a big box office draw.
And it
could conceivably be an awards draw and get a small and very appreciative audience, but who's going to flock into the theater on Christmas Day to see The Road?
And so is there a business model, David, for a movie like that if it's not going to be a big audience getter?
Let's talk about Precious, which is being brought along very carefully, where the star...
Another dark film in a different, more personal kind of way.
Yeah, it does have a little bit of a hug to it, but there's, you know, you have a star, a main character who's a deeply troubled person, a very large person.
An obese young woman. She's abused by her parents. She has two children as a result of rape by her father, just to set up the cheery plot.
Yeah, other than that, it's a walk in the park, not to mention that her mother is played by Monique, the comedian, who may have generated one of the darkest cinematic characters. The mother makes Joan Crawford look like June Cleaver. I mean, it's a very scary movie, but there is uplift as you go, and what they've done with it in a business sense is stage it, release it carefully and slowly into mostly audiences with a lot of black theater goers, and then gradually, slowly, tried to get the build off the critics and off the good word of mouth from those early audiences and end up talking to much larger groups. In this instance, from a business standpoint, I think it certainly works, although it's nice to have Oprah on your team and pushing it along.
Talking about some of the serious movies being released in these recent weeks with David Carr, New York Times media business writer, and Slate.com's movie critic, Dana Stevens. I want to play a cut from The Lovely Bones. This is an adaptation of a 2002 novel by Alice Siebold. It's the story of a teenage girl who gets raped and murdered, who then watches over her family from heaven, directed by Lord of the Rings director Peter Jackson. Here's a clip of the dad, played by Mark Wahlberg, teaching his daughter to make those ships in a bottle.
Did Mom know before she married you?
Hmm?
About your obsession.
Susie, hobbies are healthy. They teach you things.
Like what?
Like if you start something, you finish it. You don't stop until you get it right. If you don't get it right, you start over again, and you keep on going as long as you have to. That's the way it is. That's what you do. It's perfectly normal. No, Grampy taught me to do this, and now I'm teaching you. We're creating something here for us, something special.
I know.
And my first mate, Susie Q. One day all of this will be yours.
Jack! Susie!
Mm-hmm.
Dinner!
Hey, wait.
Ready?
Yeah.
Now hold her steady.
Okay.
Okay, shipmate, take it away.
Now that is a thing of beauty.
That clip from The Lovely Bones, and wow, Dana Stevens, I don't know what it's like when you're watching that film, but just to hear the audio, Mark Wahlberg makes his shipbuilding hobby seem kind of creepy. I haven't seen this one either. Is this of a piece in a way with Precious?
Well, I think that's Brian Eno at work with the score somehow making the shipbuilding scene sound creepy. Well, the subject matter is, you know, basically as dark as you can get, right? A 14-year-old girl is murdered at the very beginning of the story. That's no spoiler, and we spend the whole time watching her solve her murder from behind the grave. So it's pretty dark, but I feel like it also has a suspense thriller side that's going to do it some good at the box office. David, you're the business guy. Has Lovely Bones been paying off for the studio?
I wonder, Dana, if they haven't waited a little bit too long and depended a little too much on critical bounce that is not forthcoming. When you hear that music, you know that Oscar, that portentous piano music, you know Oscar is in the neighborhood. I'm just wondering if they're going to get the kind of critical bounce from people like you that they need to get people into the movie, which, as you point out, is kind of scary, kind of dark. I got a 13-year-old. It's weird. I let her read the book. I don't know about going to the movie.
And another one on your list, Dana, is Jeff Bridges playing a down-and-out country music singer in Crazy Heart. Maggie Gyllenhaal, Robert Duvall, also star. I should mention that Jeff Bridges is going to be talking about this film on the Leonard Lopez Show coming up next today. But how about that, Dana?
Oh, I'm glad you gave me a chance to talk about that one, and also that I now know Jeff Bridges is on Leonard Lopate today. But I really want to talk up this movie because it didn't, maybe David would know why, but it didn't get a lot of advance buzz. I'm only just hearing about it in the last few weeks, I guess, and Jeff Bridges is just amazing in this movie. I really, really hope he wins the Best Actor Oscar for this movie, and I like the movie a lot, too. It's the story of a down-and-out, burnt-out old country singer who's trying to make a comeback, and I feel like Jeff Bridges really takes it to the next level and becomes not just a great comic actor, which he's long been, but a really great dramatic actor in this role.
And we're going to run out of time without really talking about Invictus, but that's okay because everybody's talking about Invictus. But, Dana, this is the film in which Morgan Freeman plays Nelson Mandela, who enlists a rugby player played by Matt Damon, and together they try to unite the country post-apartheid. But is this really a sports film? Does this just have a veneer of anything serious, but it's an excuse to make a sports movie?
Kind of. Maybe David can speak to Invictus. I'm somebody who just did not get that movie. I'm neither a big sports movie person nor a big Clint Eastwood person. And to me, Invictus seemed like a very by-the-numbers, conventional, inspirational sports movie with a slim frame of this veneer of a political story that didn't really teach you that much about South Africa. So sell me on it, somebody.
David?
I probably won't be the person doing the selling. I think given the firepower arrayed over it with Morgan and Matt Damon and Clint Eastwood, my expectations were a little high. Although I don't think it's so much about sports in the same way that Friday Night Lights, the television show, is not really about sports. We have the overlay of sports, and you sort of know how that's going to turn out, and supposedly you're going to be enriched and learn in between. And as Dana pointed out, I don't know how much you really learn.
All right, David, 20 seconds. How about movie surprises from any time in 2009? What did you like that you didn't see coming?
Well, I think that everybody's talking about Blindside, talking about by the numbers. It didn't really knock me down. I loved An Education, which is a small movie that's doing really, really well and is still out there and available to see. Not the best ending in the world, but really first-rate performances.
Dana, your positive surprise of 2009?
Oh, gee, that's a good one. I think maybe my positive surprise of the year was how much I loved Fantastic Mr. Fox. I don't think that I foresaw that I would find that movie as delightful and one of my favorites of the year as I did.
How come?
Because I felt like Wes Anderson's career started out really interesting and had been sort of slowly in decline, always sort of almost getting there, but not quite. And then he finally hit another one out of the park, and I feel like I'm interested in everything he does now.
Could not agree more.
David
Wonderful
Carr.
Film.
New York Times media business columnist who also loves the movies, and Dana Stevens, who reviews them for a living for Slate.com. Thanks, both of you, very much. Happy New Year.
Same to you, Brian.
Happy New Year.
Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, and Paige Cowett produced this program. Our senior producer is Megan Ryan. I'm Brian Lehrer.